Hear that? That's the sound of the 2018 World Cup in the United States. No goals to celebrate.
And Dempsey's going at it! The U.S. ahead! Incredible!
No chance to yell. No memories to make.
Oh, can you believe this? Go, go, USA!
You've tried to move on. You've told yourself that you're over it. But inside, you know the truth. So let's lay it out one last time.
As a whole, U.S. soccer is not prepared.
So we can all move on together.
They have not done a good enough job of getting this group ready to play.
Caught Offside presents U.S. Soccer and the 2018 World Cup. Turn the page. Now here's Andrew Gunling and J.J. Devaney. Turn the page.
Oh, yes. Caught Offside from the Upper West Side of Manhattan. It is Andrew Gunling, and it is J.J. Devaney. What's up, brother?
Wow, that was special.
You all right? You need to take a minute?
There's so much going on in that. You've been busy.
Oh, man, here we are. Here we are, Amir. What has it been, 7 months since you and I were sitting in these very same seats, watching those TVs right over there to my left in utter shock and disbelief over what we had just seen at Otto Bolden Stadium in Trinidad and what we had seen developing in the Panama match.
You've really taken me back to that place.
Honduras match, yes. Well, that's why we're here, is because I'll give total transparency. I don't think we ever really had any intention of doing this. And what we're actually doing here is going to be a special three-part series leading up to the start of the World Cup and profiling the U.S. and what happened and where they're going. We're going to talk with Jeff Carlisle in both parts one and two. Part one, which we're doing now, based on how this all happened. Why is there a World Cup that is starting in a week and we're not a part of it? Part two, we'll get into the future and just how things are projecting moving forward. Has change come? Are you seeing new players that you're excited about? And then part three, JJ is going to be a special interview with Bruce Arena. He will join us in the third part of this three-part series. And like I was about to say, the reason we're doing this, we didn't have any intention of doing it. I think, A, part of it is that I'll speak for myself. I'm not going to speak for you. But I kind of found myself as the World Cup was coming back and you're watching games and you're seeing commercials for it. You're seeing some of our friendlies. And I think with the World Cup now being here, it's kind of drudged up a lot of those feelings again. And I think we were seeing some of that with what we were getting on Twitter from people. Yeah. I know I've been hearing some of that from friends. And, you know, articles came out. Jeff Carlisle, who will be on, like I said, had a great profile of everything that had happened with the U.S.
Almost a chronology. Yeah.
And then The Ringer also did a great job in presenting one of their own. I think both pieces really kind of complemented each other. You saw a lot of kind of similar sentiments coming out of both of them. And it got the U.S., the American fan base, kind of re-fired up all over again. So we felt like for us to enjoy the World Cup the way that we want to, this once every 4 year tournament, I think we had to do this one last time. Let's talk about it. Let's move on together. And then next Thursday we'll roll around. We'll release the Bruce interview and we'll be done with this chapter of American soccer and we'll enjoy the tournament. And then it's just going to be full steam ahead at the future.
Yeah. So the podcast we did after the night at the Otto Bolden Stadium was crisis management. And this podcast is now group therapy.
Sort like when you, but after that night, like you saw your therapist, because we talked about what happened for weeks and weeks.
We did, but we never did it in any kind of structured manner.
But this is now like you have to go back to your therapist for kind of like, you know, a follow up just to make sure how are we doing now? Like the dust has settled. How are you doing, bud?
It's like Tony Soprano and his final sit down with Dr. Melfi.
Yeah, it's exactly like that. And now we're walking into the diner and Journey's playing in the background and you just don't know what's about to happen.
That feels like where we are right now.
Yeah.
We're walking into the diner.
And Meta's out there parking the car and you just are waiting for...
Which is kind of a metaphor for U.S. soccer trying to park and rest itself with the new GM.
So here we go. Tonight, like I said, we'll be profiling the past. And basically how did this happen? I still kind of wonder about that. And I've broken this down into three different categories because everybody, even to this day, the reason this is all so interesting to me is because here we are and it's been analyzed to death, but I don't know that we're any closer to a concrete answer. I think we have a lot more information at our hands today than what we had several months ago.
But we're not at a consensus as to what happened.
So let's start in this blame game that we're going to play here. Let's look at the first one, and for a lot of people, the most obvious one, the managers, plural, because obviously this campaign was a carryover from Jurgen Klinsmann into Bruce Arena. The more that I parse through all this, the more I absolve is way too strong. But the more that I kind of remove Bruce Arena a little bit more from the equation of why this happened, and the more I really hone in on Jurgen Klinsmann, and maybe even more specifically than that, Sunil Gulati. And I feel bad saying that because you and I held on to Klinsmann longer than we should have, right? Well, I think you and I have to do a little bit of soul searching too.
Certainly, and Jeff's piece and certainly the guys from The Ringer, who we should mention, Andrew Helms and Matt Pence, illuminated us on things we had suspected about Klinsmann. The reason we held on, though, Andrew, and certainly the reason that I held on, this was my first cycle, what a cycle, of CONCACAF qualification. And I would get worried about a defeat. For example, in the first round of qualifying.
Guatemala.
Yeah. I would get really concerned about a performance and you would go, look, it's not great, but the hex is where things happen. There's, you know, two automatic spots and a third playoff spot. You know, we're not
going to... No.
Sorry.
Three automatics and a fourth playoff.
Oh my God, I'm making it even harder. Three automatics in the fourth. So you were always kind of guiding me through saying, don't worry about it. And that kind of bled into Klinsmann. Because we had serious question marks. We had question marks going back to 2014. One of our question marks was the preparation, where we talked about the tough physical work we were hearing was happening at camp. And we were like, why is he running a preseason before the World Cup? These guys have just come off their own domestic seasons. Some of them are in the middle of the domestic season, certainly for the MLS players. Why is this happening? And then we look at the Ringer article and we look at Jeff's article and we see that the emperor had no clothes was one of the terms that was used. This guy who came in with the plan didn't really have a plan. And Gulati waited and waited till, like you said, it was too late to pull the trigger on firing him. But we had noticed things, but we were always pulling back from what seemed like a reactionary move. A, because Klinsmann had bought a lot of goodwill with the 2014 World Cup. And also, I guess he had bought time with Gulati and also with qualification because of the nature of qualification. But we did see warning signs.
You're absolutely right. And I remember the first night where that started to hit me that, because there were always rumblings about Klinsmann. Are we real? You know, after that World Cup, even though it was a fun World Cup, but there were still questions. Are we really moving forward in the way that we had been promised? Are we just running in place? I blocked all that out, but it wasn't until the 2015 Gold Cup when the U.S. lost to Jamaica. I remember exactly where I was. I was in Chicago in a hotel room. I'd watched the first half at a bar, came back to the hotel and watched the second half. U.S. lost 2-1. And I remember we were still somewhat early in this podcast. So our social media presence wasn't quite what it is now, or the podcast popularity isn't quite what it is now. And that was the first night where my Twitter mentions exploded.
Yeah,
of people demanding essentially that this is it. This is what we've been waiting for, and we got to get this guy out. And I remember I spent the whole night sitting on my bed in the hotel room defending Klinsmann and say, we don't want to be one of those countries that just acts on a whim. Look at how these goals were scored. Klinsmann himself, afterwards, there were rumblings where he's saying the match was fixed. Now, I'm not going to go that far, but you look at the call against Brad Guzan that led to the first goal. JJ, it happens every game. And for some reason, they chose to call it that night. Giles Barnes, his header to put Jamaica up. They scored those two goals in that five-minute stretch. I defended Klinsmann that night. And I still say that it was too early, but I do believe that there were certain things that some people were seeing that maybe, for whatever reason, I don't know why, but for whatever reason, you and I, me maybe more so even, I don't want to keep lumping you in, I was turning kind of a blind eye to it.
I remember being at home, and you were live on the radio for a different show, not a caught offside, not a soccer endorsed show. Mm-hmm. And I texted you, said, you've got to talk about this defeat to Guatemala. And you were like, don't worry about it. I will mention it, but you're getting upset. Another moment that, can I put it to you, was the defeat by Argentina in the Copa America Centenario. The 4-0 hammering. Now look, that's the greatest player in the world on potentially one of the best teams. Well, it is one of the best teams in the world. Mm-hmm. But just the team, the way Klinsmann suddenly brought in Chris Wondolowski, the kind of change in emphasis of that side. Even that tournament itself, the first game against Colombia where we were roundly beaten.
Yeah.
Now we recovered, we picked up a few wins, but against opposition that we should be beating. Mm-hmm. Then I was wondering, I don't know, is this guy, does he really know what he's doing? He seems to oscillate wildly between teams. And Galati said he wanted a certain ethic in the side, a certain way of playing. I never felt we got that.
You're right. And I do think that with him, we typically appreciated his desire to push guys to Europe,
definitely,
to test themselves. That was, he was so outspoken about that to the hatred of Don Garber and MLS. But I think, deep down inside, I think we all kind of thought that that was something that was important for the U.S. to continue to develop in the way that we all hoped. The other thing, of course, was Landon Donovan not being included in the World Cup squad. At the time, we rationalized it by saying,
well, we didn't. We thought it was a mistake.
We were shocked by it, but you were able to rationalize it by saying, oh, well, you're going to take the sabbatical and then think you're going to walk back into the squad. Jurgen's telling you that it doesn't work that way. But then the tweet from Jonathan Klinsmann afterwards, it was, even though it was quickly deleted and it wasn't Jurgen himself saying it, but it was a glimpse into the mindset that they don't like this guy, that there was something deeper there than just he doesn't fit on this team. It felt like it was something more personal than that. That affected a lot of people, and I think it affected that locker room. And then you hear about the rifts that had formed between some of the German-American players, that there was this belief that they were receiving preferential treatment. It just felt like Klinsmann, for whatever reason, had a toxic atmosphere had been created in that locker room, and it was allowed to exist for way too long. And so then we move into Bruce Arena, and I don't want to say that it was beyond saving at that point, because it wasn't beyond saving
until the last 5 minutes.
Right, because he had come back and saved it. I do think, I don't know, I look at the things that we now feel like Bruce did wrong, and I feel like it's almost a little bit unfair to rip him for some of those things, because like everybody points to the fact, one of the most interesting parts of the article that Jeff Carlisle wrote, I thought, was when Paul Areola talked about playing in the Panama match, and everyone was just flying in that game. 4-0, bang, we're feeling good. Get that result in Trinidad, and we did this. We did what needed to be done. But Paul Areola then talks about that he plays the same team, and he was just exhausted. He had no legs, couldn't move that night. I don't remember the outcry when the lineup was released. Like, when I saw it was the same 11 starting against Trinidad that started against Panama, I thought, yeah, like, let's keep going. Like, they looked awesome the other night.
Yeah.
So,
and also as well, I think in that game, they were flat, certainly, but you can't legislate for what happened to Omar Gonzalez. Like, in the pantheon of freak goals, that's up there. I mean, he obviously didn't cover himself in glory in the way he went to attack the ball, but no one could have expected that to happen. I think the problem was they say this about so many different types of sport, and they say it about even other different parts of life, the army and workplaces, and it's that you don't know yourself until you're in a fight. You don't know yourself until you're under pressure. The problem for the US team was this fight and the spirit was never going to be exposed when things were going their way. When they went 1-0 down in Trinidad, there is no way a team of that experience, a team of that caliber, with the players they had at the resources, no matter what you personally think of those players, they were better than that Trinidad and Tobago team on that night.
Yep.
The fact the fissures and the issues and the divide in the team suddenly blew open when adversity came knocking. And when that ball flew into the net, they couldn't find a way to pull themselves back. And we've seen it in both Jeff's article and the Ringer article, that halftime, they were done.
It was like a morgue.
A morgue.
With the coaching staff trying to rile players up. And it was just, and sure enough, you know, that the other thing you have to remember is the U.S. were down 2-0, but results elsewhere were going exactly the way they needed to go. Pulisic comes out within the first minutes of the second half, scores a goal. I remember being in here feeling good. Like, okay, maybe we're going to get out of this alive. Like, there was never any part of me that thought it was going to end the way that it ended until it ended. And I was going to save this, but whatever, you kind of referenced it, so let's get to it now. You know, I said this that night, and I don't think people were ready to hear it then, but here we are 7 months later, and I still feel this way. Yes, Coach Klinsmann, there were problems. Arena, not everything went right. We'll talk about the players because there were guys who were not up for it, clearly. But here's the other thing. Luck was also part of this. You mentioned Omar Gonzalez, and I know you can say luck is the residue of design. He went into that ball badly, and bad things happen when you lose focus. But, I mean, my God. The way that that ball – you watch a lot of – when was the last time you saw something like that? I mean, like, seriously.
Yeah.
The goal from Alvin Jones. Will he ever score another goal like that?
He'll never strike a ball as clean as that again.
It was unbelievable. And then to watch the way things played out, Panama scoring a goal that should have never been allowed to count, Honduras scoring the goal where the ball hits the crossbar and bounces off the back of Guillermo Ochoa's head and rolls into the net – insane things happened.
The problem was, though, because I've got to stop you here.
Yeah.
In our proper revision of this, the problem with all this is that it should never have gone to the last game.
You're
that
absolutely
is the
right.
Whole issue. The two defeats home and away to Costa Rica. We only had one win in the entirety, in both rounds of CONCACAF qualifying. One away win against St. Vincent and the Grenadine Islands. That's not good enough.
You're totally right. Here's the only other thing that I would say to go against that is, okay, so we didn't get in. Like this idea of we're maybe better off for it now, like all of these ills within the program have now been exposed that you're talking about. I don't know that I totally buy that. And we'll talk more about where the team is headed in the next podcast.
Right.
But, like, I'm sure it was known in that locker room that there were issues. And after this World Cup, even if the U.S. were in it, things were going to be addressed. You know, changes inevitably were still going to happen. People say that, like, if the U.S. had won, it was simply just papering over the cracks and the fissures that you talk about. I think, so what? What does that mean? Weston McKennie was just, and Tyler Adams weren't going to be guys and who were going to be looked to? Like, no,
it really has fast-tracked their development.
Yes, it has. But, like, the wheel of progress was still going to be turning. We were still going to see these guys become key members of the U.S. team moving forward. I can't help but keep – look at South Korea. We're going to do their group preview coming up. Probably that'll be out tomorrow. But, like, look at – they just got into this World Cup. Look at the qualifying campaign they just had. They were terrible. Look at Mexico 4 years ago. Like – and we look at where Mexico is now. Are they a disaster? No. We actually think pretty highly of them. So sometimes the idea of, look, was this perfect? Was this a thing of beauty? No. The team isn't as good as we thought. The manager situation isn't good. But let's just get in, and we'll deal with all that afterwards. So That's.
I'm not, but we're going to talk about it on our future podcast. Even with everything that's happened, I'm not sure we're dealing with it right now.
Well, you're right, and you can talk about who the new head man is of U.S. soccer, and is it meet the new boss, same as the old boss. But we are dealing with it because we're seeing the lineups that they're marching out there for these friendlies, and they're doing the things that they're supposed to do. Before we get to Jeff Carlisle, we've talked a lot about Bruce Arena and Jurgen Klinsmann, but what about the players? Like something, there's something to be said. We can't. The blame has to go to them as well. Like these are good players, and they so underperformed. And it's so easy to point the finger at the manager, but these guys have got to take responsibility too.
We can point to three at the back versus Mexico on like 4 days preparation, which is crazy, and that was a Klinsmann thing. But you go against Costa Rica and you're playing an orthodox back four, and John Brooks has the kind of game that he had. Just individual mistake, terrible individual mistakes. You look at, for example, going forward into the Costa Rica game. Look at what happened between Ream and Cameron. Just individual mistakes. Mm-hmm. Tim Howard, individual mistakes. And you look at then what happened against Trinidad and Tobago. The players have to take responsibility. Yeah. And the players came up short. They really did. Some of them will probably be scratching their heads. They play week in, week out, and they don't make these kind of mistakes. But there were a lot of individual errors. Now, where do those individual errors come from? A lack of confidence in the instructions they've been given? You can make that argument, surely. But these are professionals. And I particularly look at the hammering in Costa Rica. That was the night where my eyes were like fully open to the concept that, yeah, we may qualify, but we are way off.
And you know, there's one other thing too, and I remember we talked about this. I think I even gave him my red card. Performances are one thing, but the mental aspect of the game. I believe it was the loss in Harrison, New Jersey to Costa Rica.
Mm.
And remember late in that game, Jozy Altidore picked up just a dumb yellow card.
Screaming at someone, I think.
Right, and it caused him to be suspended then for the Honduras match at San Pedro Sula, which has always been a difficult place for the U.S. to go. And Josie's somebody with experience. He's looked to as, you know, one of the veterans of this team. And now he's missing that game. And the U.S. struggled. And if it wasn't for that late goal from Bobby Wood, they lose 1-0. Yeah. Do I know that if Jozy Altidore plays, we win that game 2-1 or 3-1? No, I don't know that. But I would have liked to have found out.
Right.
You know, so things like that, like just avoidable mistakes that just kind of maybe were a window into the psyche of where these players were at.
That was a particularly horrifying performance. I mean, Honduras will look at that game and think, how do we not win that?
Yeah.
I mean, and the equalizer, I think it was Bobby Wood
got
it.
It was Wood, yeah.
You remember the relief when we scored that?
Oh, my God, you and I, we got up, we hugged.
Yeah, we were screaming. Peter Rosenberg was in there, and he recorded it because he couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean,
You're bringing me back, buddy. It's not even that long ago.
I still look at the players, and it's the only thing that makes me uncomfortable with so much blame going to the managers is that, like, I look at these guys, and I see guys who are accomplished, talented players that just didn't, you know, I don't care. You know, so you lacked some direction from the manager.
Is that an excuse?
That's an excuse for all of this?
You abdicate your responsibilities when you step on the field, because when you step on the field, you're on your own. Can I tell you a story that kind of crosses over? Giovanni Trapattoni, as Ireland manager, was a fairly divisive character in the style of play that he wanted. And Ireland played a two-legged World Cup qualifier and playoff against France. You all remember it. The first game was in Dublin, and Ireland played terribly and lost 1-0. And they really didn't show up. There was a collective will. Nobody said it, but it was just spoken on the back of the bus going into Saint-Denis that night for the second leg. Guys, let's go out there and play. We've got nothing to lose. And the style of play was changed. It didn't come from the manager. It was players. It was seasoned pros, Damien Duff, Robbie Keane, who went out and said, we've got to play better. We've got to be better. This is on us. Mm-hmm. Now, you would get a... How many think pieces or thought pieces about leaders on the US men's national team? Bradley, guys who've been to World Cups, Tim Howard. These are guys who are always going on about assuming responsibility and talking about leadership. There was no leadership. When it came to it, all that talk meant nothing.
Well, yeah, maybe. I don't know.
No, no, no. I mean, No. Do you remember the talk after the Panama game? We're just talking about qualifying. We're focusing on qualifying. There was an arrogance to this team that you thought was confidence, but it was empty. Because when push came to shove, there was no Damien Duff, Robbie Keane in this team that got everyone together. The fissures, the divides were so much that it was the minute adversity started, they couldn't come back from it.
I know.
That's the way I read it.
You read things like what was written about Timmy Chandler telling Bobby Wood, Bobby Wood was kind of nursing an injury.
So let's set the scene. It was after the Mexico 2-1 defeat in Columbus.
This is from the Ringer.
Yeah, this is from the Ringer piece. And they're going to Costa Rica. And Bobby Wood is trying to establish himself at Hamburg. Fine. But Bobby Wood's definitely starting up front. Definitely. And he had a few knocks and bruises. And Timmy Chandler advised him or said to him, look, they don't pay the bills. The US men's national team don't pay the bills. Look after, make sure you're available for the team that pays the bills.
It's just the wrong, attitude, and
it's the right attitude if it's a friendly game and meaningless game. This is a qualifier away after a defeat to Mexico.
And, you know, I'm glad you bring up friendlies also, because I do think
I've been vindicated on this front.
You so have, because I think it's talked about with Sunil Gulati and his just refusal to part with Klinsmann. And one of the things that is mentioned is that the U.S. had gone to some places and won games that you wouldn't have expected them to win. And I can only assume that they're referring to when the U.S. went to Azteca and beat Mexico or Italy or the Netherlands. And those were all friendlies.
Yeah.
Decisions about things as important as the manager can't be made off of results from friendlies.
I absolutely agree with you. Again, I'll just use a quick Irish comparison. Steve Staunton wins 2-0 in his first game at home against a good Sweden team. Andrew, we lost in qualifying 5-2 in Cyprus. That you just can't do it. Friendlies are not... I think friendlies had more importance when the international calendar was smaller. And so, you know, there are certain friendly games you look back in the 1980s, and I think they were important. They mean nothing now.
Yeah.
They mean nothing now since the expansion of the club calendar and more important things. They don't matter, and January camps don't matter. None of it matters.
I know. It's all just so amazing thinking about it, going back to Klinsmann too, like how close they were to beating Belgium. And then, like, I just wonder how if Klinsmann does that thing that only Bruce Arena had done and gets the U.S. to a quarterfinal of a World Cup, like I just wonder how that do they give him even more rope? Like, does he see it through?
Look all the
qualifying
rope he got for getting to the last 16.
I know,
unbelievable. You know, from the Ringer piece, and it was a general tone. I'm sure we'll get Jeff to talk about it. You can't have players going out onto the field having to talk to themselves to try and figure out the way they're playing.
I know. That's shocking to hear.
It is shocking to hear that from a guy who was one of the highest paid managers in world football.
And the problem is, it shouldn't have been a surprise for anyone to hear that, because Philipp Lahm said the same thing about Klinsmann. When was it? In 2011?
It was 2009 when he only lasted briefly in the job.
Right, but those comments were made public in 11?
Yeah, he said that they didn't know.
They'd be talking to each other like in the huddle,
trying to figure it out right before the game. It's scary.
Yeah, it is. I'll tell you what. Let's go now. Jeff Carlisle, if you haven't read it yet, he wrote such a great, compelling piece on all of this. He's been obviously one of our favorite people to have on this podcast since day one. And we thought that he's the right guy to have on both tonight in part one and in part two. Tonight, we spoke with him earlier. We'll play for you tonight the portion of the interview where he talks about all of this, essentially, and the things that went wrong. Let's go back now and take a listen. This is Jeff Carlisle with us earlier today on Caught Offside. The first question that JJ and I have been talking a lot about the past several months, so much of it has been about the blame game. Let's start there, but with a specific focus on the managers. From the people that you've spoken with, do you get a sense of whether or not this was more a Jurgen issue, a Bruce Arena issue? I mean, who do people seem to be pointing the finger at a little more strongly?
Well, I think more people are pointing the finger at Jurgen, but I almost think that's more a function of time. I mean, he was in the job for, but 5 years. So, it was, I think it was just a situation where there was a little bit more raw material from which to dig. But that's not to say that Bruce Arena shouldn't shoulder a good chunk of the blame. There was a lot of talk about chemistry and he couldn't quite get it right. And, if only he'd had more time. But then you look at some of the performances and, 6-0 over Honduras and 4-0 over Panama and an absolute crunch, everything on the line, World Cup qualifier. And you're wanting, it left me to wonder, how much of a problem was chemistry really? And then you get into some of his tactical decisions, especially in that last game against Trinidad and Tobago. And, he always kind of, walked a high wire act with Michael Bradley. There were some occasions where he played him as like a lone holding midfielder and pushing Christian Pulisic up high. And he tended to do that at home. And then on the road, he would understandably get a little bit more conservative and have someone like Kellen Acosta beside Bradley to kind of just cover some more ground and provide a little bit more of a shield in front of the back line. So, the fact that he didn't do that in a game that he only had to draw, I think Bruce deserves some criticism for that. Certainly he could never quite, reach Jeff Cameron. Certainly the way things bore out with Omar Gonzalez and his performances, there's a lot of what might have been. So I think the fact that Jurgen was there longer and the extent to which the locker room and kind of the vibe within the team had eroded, certainly in the piece that I wrote, there was a source that was quoted. It was, by the time they played Costa Rica away, it was a beaten team. It was a defeated team. And so, that played a huge, a significant role, I would say, in how things ended up. But, Bruce Arena deserves some criticism for sure. And, he can't come off blameless here. I mean, some decisions that he made directly impacted how things went down throughout World Cup qualifying when he was in charge. So I would shade it towards Jurgen, but, Bruce, I think, still deserves some blame as well.
Can I talk to you about the start of the campaign a little bit, Jeff, under Klinsmann, and kind of focus on Klinsmann a little bit. There was a moment in the Mexico game in Columbus where Michael Bradley and a number of the players went to the sideline and they looked completely confused as to what formation they were playing, what they were doing. And that for a moment was a moment for me that I felt maybe the coach doesn't have a handle on what he wants to do with this team, and the players certainly don't. During that period before he was sacked after the Costa Rica game, was there moments for you where you looked at things and thought, maybe the emperor has no clothes here? Maybe there is a case that Klinsmann is winging it.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that game that you alluded to, and I wrote this in the immediate aftermath of the game, I mean, what is he doing going to three at the back and practicing that for 2 days before, a World Cup qualifier against your biggest rival? And you saw how confused the U.S. was defensively. Timmy Chandler was just overrun on the right side of the U.S. defense. And it was definitely telling to see Jermaine Jones and Michael Bradley walk over. I think it was Andres Guardado who went down injured, and that kind of gave the U.S. players a chance to walk over to Klinsmann and say, hey, this is not working. We've got to change this. And sure enough, they did, and the U.S. began to play much better after that. But, I think there was a real disconnect between what Jurgen thought the players were capable of absorbing tactically, what the players were comfortable with tactically. I mean, like it or not, historically the U.S. has been a 4-4-2 country. I mean, you can tweak it and, manipulate it, shape the midfield how you want, whether it's a flat four or a diamond or whatever, but that is really what the U.S. is comfortable with. And, in the story that I wrote, one of the sources said that his message to the players was confusing tactically. I mean, they never really knew what was going on. And it's one thing to keep players on their toes, but it's another thing to completely befuddle them so that they have no idea what's supposed to happen on the field. I remember right after that game, Michael Bradley said, you need to have clear ideas. And the strong implication there was that the U.S. didn't. And that's why they look so confused on the field. So, I think the emperor has no clothes vibe had been building for a while. I mean, granted, there are people out there who, for whom Jurgen Klinsmann could do no wrong. I really believe that, he, just the way that he operated. I mean, I remember Omar Gonzalez talking about how confused he was when Jurgen was in charge. So I think you add all that up and you have a team that really was no longer responding to Klinsmann's message. They responded, I think, during the 2014 cycle, which is why I kind of tend to divvy up Klinsmann's tenure with the national team. There's 2014 and then there's the 2018 cycle. So I think it worked well enough in 2014, but I think that message no longer resonated with the group during the 2018 cycle.
Jeff, you alluded to this a little bit a few minutes ago, but I want to ask you a little more on it. The rift that people have been talking about within that locker room, specifically, it seemed from your article, the German-Americans versus the rest of them, just how prevalent was that?
It depends on who you talk to. I mean, I talked to Fabian Johnson, and he said, that's something that's made up by the media or people outside the team. But, you talk to other insiders, and those were people that chose to remain anonymous for the piece that I wrote. It still existed. I mean, this was something that was never really addressed, after the 2014 World Cup. And so I think to a large extent that's still, that still existed. That still took place. Now, when Arena came in, it was pretty clear that he took an approach where he was going to rely more heavily on domestic players, on MLS players. And, there are some who say that, that was to blame. I mean, certainly the German-Americans let the U.S. team down badly on plenty of occasions, and there are times where the MLS players let the team down. So, I mean, I think there's give and take in that, but I think it did exist. I mean, you talk to people like Tim Howard, and he talked about how Bruce did a good job of eradicating the players who weren't really bought in. And to me, that tells me that this issue had not gone away, that this issue was still prevalent. And all of these things kind of add up to chip away at the team's mentality and identity. And I know some people just kind of poo-poo that whole notion, right? But I think it matters. I mean, I think the U.S. team that you've seen during this cycle looks nothing like the teams of yore, just in terms of the all-for-one attitude. I think that matters. And tactics matter, too, without question. So, again, I think all of these things kind of added up to really undermine the effectiveness of the team on the field. And you could see it just in the different explanations that the players had. I mean, Ali Bedoya talked about complacency. Paul Areola, hey, I was tired. I was gassed. I had nothing left for that turn of that game. So, again, you add all these things up, and it kind of collectively explains why the U.S. isn't going to the World Cup.
After the Trinidad and Tobago game, after that fatal game, Sunil Gulati came into sharp focus for a lot of people who probably hadn't focused on him very much beforehand. Jeff, the relationship between Gulati and Klinsmann, Gulati pursued Klinsmann aggressively. How much has this whole disaster come down to the fact that Sunil Gulati couldn't let go of the fact that the project with Klinsmann was failing and that he didn't pull the trigger in time?
I think that's a component of it for sure. And it's, in Bruce Arena's book, he details about how, that Sunil Gulati and Dan Flynn, who's the CEO of US Soccer, I mean, they had made up their minds to get rid of Klinsmann, and they had Arena lined up. And I think Doug McIntyre and I reported at the time that they had reached out to Peter Vermes as well. And then, Dan Flynn has his heart transplant surgery. And I guess my question in all that is, why was that decision so dependent on one person? Why? And I think that speaks to Sunil's leadership style as well. It was one or two people that were making all these decisions rather than seeking out the board and trying to get their input that way. The fact that Klinsmann lasted through the Copa America and through the semifinal round of qualifying, I mean, I think that played a factor as well. I mean, and I think it was really difficult for Sunil Gulati to come to grips with this. I mean, he chased Jurgen Klinsmann. I mean, Jurgen Klinsmann turned him down twice before that. You know, he finally got his guy, and I think Gulati was so invested in the idea of Klinsmann, in the hope and the promise of what he thought Klinsmann could deliver. You know, this proactive style, and you know, we're going to play this way at all levels. And you know, the player pool is the player pool, and so I think that was really tough for Sunil Gulati to let go of. I mean, he ultimately did, but you know, certainly a case could be made that if he had pulled the trigger earlier, the U.S. might not have been in the position it finds itself in now.
I guess to kind of ask a question branching off of that, I've never understood, I hope this doesn't sound too cold, but I've never quite understood the correlation between Dan Flynn's heart surgery and the decision to delay the coaching change. I mean, Sunil Gulati just didn't feel like that. Was that a sign to him that this wasn't the right time to do? I've just never really understood the correlation between those two things.
Yeah, I mean, I think Dan Flynn, as CEO, I mean, I think he would have been involved in just the, you know, fleshing out the financial details of a prospective arena contract. And, you know, for whatever reason, you know, I think at that point, Gulati didn't feel comfortable going forward with it. And so, I mean, I think it was purely about the negotiation and trying to get that done. And I think Sunil just didn't feel right about proceeding ahead with that without Dan Flynn by his side. And so, but it does speak to kind of the way the USSF was run under Gulati's presidency. I mean, it was him and Dan Flynn kind of making a lot of the decisions and kind of, you know, pushing the board aside. I mean, I've talked to board members about this, about how it really grated that Sunil would say, okay, I've decided to fire this coach, you know, whether it was Jurgen, whether it was Tom Sermani on the women's side, without really any discussion. I mean, it's, you know, the decision has been made. This is who we're hiring. This is how we're going forward. I need you guys to vote, you know, and approve it. And they would. And this came up during the election for USSF president, was that, you know, the board was going to kind of take back the power that is really theirs to begin with. And granted, it's only been a few months. I mean, it's only been, 4 months since Carlos Cordero got elected. So I think it's still unclear, you know, how much he's going to follow through on that promise. But, you know, I think that's what the case was with Dan Flynn and Gulati not feeling comfortable, because, you know, he evidently felt it was very important that Flynn sign off on this deal. I find that puzzling myself. Why couldn't a deputy or someone else within U.S. soccer take over that duty? And I mean, if the decision had already been made to get rid of Klinsmann, I agree. I don't quite understand why it felt like they couldn't go forward. But I don't know if you've had a chance to read Arena's book, but in that passage, he details, you know, that's why Jurgen did not get fired in that moment just before Copa America. And, you know, that's why that decision was delayed.
Jeff, brass tacks, going into the final game, they only needed a point. It seemed like eminently, well within their powers to get that kind of result. I'm always curious about people, and particularly journalists, prior to a big game, an important game, whether they get a sense around the camp that something was off, that something wasn't right, that players were fatigued, that there was some element that wasn't quite clicking. Had you any sense prior to kickoff in Trinidad and Tobago that perhaps something was afoot or that things weren't quite right?
No, because they had played so well against Panama. I mean, they absolutely crushed Panama that night. I mean, they were completely on top of their game, and Pulisic was running wild, and, you know, everyone played well. And so, to me, that was the hard part. I mean, you're talking about a Panama team that hardly conceded at all, you know, during the hex. I mean, granted, they didn't score a lot either. I mean, that was kind of the why they, you know, the reason why they were kind of riding the ragged edge a little bit. But, you know, I think my thinking was that even if the U.S. plays poorly, they're going to get a draw out of this. I mean, and so, I mean, there was a little bit of, I mean, the whole situation with the flooded stadium field and you know, the last practice that was basically not a practice at all. I mean, it was, you know, they weren't really able to do much of anything. You know, I mean, that can make things seem, you know, abnormal, but the memory for me that was freshest in my mind was they absolutely crushed Panama. I mean, Panama is a much better team than Trinidad and Tobago.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my thinking is this team, regardless of who Arena puts out there, they're talented enough and they should be good enough to get the job done. And, but I think, again, I do think a little bit of complacency, a little bit of overconfidence. And you saw this throughout the Hex. I mean, they'd have one really good performance and then they could never follow it up with another really good performance. You know, I think that Panama game away where they tied 1-1, I mean, that was a game that I think was there for the taking. But, you know, they didn't get that done. They didn't win a single game on the road during the Hex. And, I mean, a lot of people point to the two home losses, and yet that was, you know, it had been a long time since that had happened, but they didn't get a single win on the road. And, you know, one thing you could usually count on for the U.S. was for them to get a win or two and really kind of solidify their position, and that didn't happen either. But going back to your original question, I thought they were going to do it. I mean, I didn't see any reason why. I mean, Panama had lost every game but one. They hadn't even drawn any games, if memory serves. They had one win fairly early on, and then they had lost the rest of them. So you looked at the form of the teams, and you thought the U.S. should take this one for sure.
Thanks to Jeff. You'll hear part two of that interview early next week when we release part two of this series.
When we talk about the future.
That's right. Hopefully it is a bright future. pretty interesting stuff from Jeff there.
Very interesting stuff. And, you know, those moments where we wondered about the emperor or no clothes, I'm glad he kind of saw what we were seeing, and the alarm bells were ringing for him too, particularly when Guardado got injured in Columbus. And Bradley and a couple other players went over to the sideline to ask, what formation are we playing? What are we doing here? Incredible.
Yeah. Yep. So there you go. Are you feeling any better? Is this helping or is this only making it worse?
It's amazing my recall of so many things. I love talking about football anyway, but these are some dark, like, memories. These are some, and by the way, I don't want to, look, I don't want to go over the top. It's obviously not like, you know, human bereavement or something, but
no,
we do care a ton. And it brings me back to this. Anyone who listens to this podcast knows how many hours we spent during qualification and during tournaments. Particularly
emergency podcasts after all of these. Remember that stretch when every game was starting at like 10 o'clock Eastern time?
Yeah, remember that. And we spent so many man hours in here, and I hate the fact that I'm vindicated in some of the things I thought, where I'd look at something and I thought, Matt Beasler at fullback now? I know he plays there for his club, but are you sure? We're three at the back now against Mexico.
Remember how excited we were, like Zeus Dog, and how fun all that was? Like,
yeah.
Ugh. All of it now just feels... Ugh.
Yeah. I think we got sucked up in it too. I remember cringing at the fireworks going off.
I know, I remember.
In
that
Orlando.
Was a point of contention.
It really, I'll tell you, that I was like, guys, the job's not done.
Yep. I know, we're very arrogant and we'll never be that way again. There's little things that I was noticing where the U.S. is trying to change that. I don't know if you noticed this. So obviously in the lead up to the Trinidad game, the U.S. account was tweeting out the river to Russia stuff with guys being carried across.
Which I thought was tame enough at the time.
I think way too much was made of that, but whatever, that aside. But then leading up to the Ireland friendly, the U.S. account tweeted out a video of like the players walking out of the tunnel, not even before the game, like just kind of a training session to see the stadium. and like this video of them like looking around it in awe of the Aviva yeah. Stadium, just like
it's a beautiful stadium.
This is, it is, but like it just, I watched that and I was like, yep, they're doing everything the opposite of what they did that night in Trinidad.
Yeah, except they tweeted out, top of the morning, we have a game. I found that.
Oh, you're so that guy. You're so that guy.
Nobody says that in Ireland, can I just tell you? Tom Cruise says it in Far and Away.
So what would be the equivalent? Like if Ireland tweeted out, like, howdy, we got a big one tonight in Texas.
Howdy, everything's bigger in Texas. Yeah. We got us a game of soccer ball.
All right, so there you go. That is pretty much part one, looking at the past. By all means, tweet us your thoughts on all this. On part two, which will be coming out sometime early next week, we'll continue our conversation with Jeff as we look to the future. Ernie Stewart being named as the general manager, which is a very interesting element of all this.
Very interesting.
So we'll get into to some of that. And then in the middle or later next week, we'll speak with Bruce Arena. And of course, please don't forget our group previews of the World Cup are continuing. E is out there now. F will be out there shortly. And we'll wrap them up next week with a World Cup general preview podcast as well. And then it all starts.
Busy,
Thursday.
busy.
Oh,
keep refreshing
this
this
is the busiest we've ever been.
Refresh that feed.
Indeed. Yeah, seriously.
I'm so glad we're handsomely paid.
Yeah. Also, the other... what also... You may laugh at this, but like all this time, these stressful hours, what if we hated each other? Like, because you hear about that on some shows. Like, I used to listen to Opie and Anthony. And I thought they were like best friends. Then I come to find out that they didn't talk for years. Like,
that stunned me.
I don't think I could fake it. Like, all this stuff that we do in here.
I couldn't fake it.
Yeah.
I mean,
if I hated you, like, these podcasts would be so uncomfortable. I don't think anybody would.
We're already planning on going for a little burger when we get this round of stuff wrapped up. Burger and a beer.
Yeah. Ah, boy. Good times. Well, hey. This was important.
This was Turning the Page with Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney.
To you, I say.
Take you later, fun boy.
See you later, man.
Take care.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.